Masango on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and DStv channel 856.
All right, and you know that we're in the middle of 16 days of activism against the abuse of women and children. And I remember I was standing in for Clement Manyathela the other day, and what had happened, I think, a day or two before that is that the Commissioner of Police here in Gauteng, Lieutenant General Mawela, had said something, and I've got to be honest with you that I sort of felt sorry for him because I think that he didn't realize what he had said when he had said something to the tune of we've got to teach women and children how not to get raped. I mean, have you ever? All right. And I suppose he is a victim of the patriarchy that most of us are victim of, right? I get that. But it sends chills down your throat. No, not throat. Your back. Sorry. Down your throat. Down your back when you realize that the man who's in charge of policing here in Gauteng has these kinds of interpretations to how rape works. That you can actually teach women and children how not to get raped. Yeah, it's scary. And then, of course, all of the conversations around the issue of the 16 days, whether or not it's effective, whether or not it's achieving what it's supposed to achieve. Mine has been, what is it actually? My question has been, what exactly is the 16 days of activism supposed to achieve? Because maybe the reason why we are not moving coherently is that we are not all on the same page. And to join me in this conversation is Christian Wendler, who is a behavioral and gender-based violence manager at Shout It Out. Christian, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Abid.
How are we doing in as far as the 16 days of activism against women or the brutalization of women and children? How are we doing in terms of what it's supposed to achieve?
Well, of course, when we look at the statistics and the hard reality of where we sit, we're not doing well enough. We're not doing enough, period. The 16 days of activism, while on one hand, this is great that we have the world that comes together with a global call to action to end one of the most widespread, normalized, and accepted human rights violations in the world today.
Yes.
One in three women have faced physical or sexual violence. A third of the female population. And so, yes, we can herald the 16 days of activism, say this is great. The world is coming together and saying this has to stop. However, it has to turn into 365 days of activism. We have to get to the point where, as you say, we do not have anyone in a leadership, let alone someone in a leadership position, saying something as ridiculous as we have to teach women how not to be raped.
What
it
is,
shows how far we have to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. What are we trying to achieve, Christian?
Well, I think, you know, with 16 days, I mean, we are trying to achieve globally a recognition of what this really is. Look at gender-based violence for the true human rights violation it is, the crime that it is, and ensure that there is adequate call to action, that there is adequate services available, legislation in place, and political will to do something about it. We happen to live in a country where we have great policies. We have laws that protect. However, many countries don't even have those laws in place. And so we are fortunate that we live in a country where we do. But then we have to ask ourselves, why, if that is the case, in a country like ours, do we still have, on average, according to the 2019-2020 statistics, the crime stats, 116 cases of rape being reported every single day? And many of those individuals never see justice. Many of those individuals have secondary victimization at the hands of the police, or are told to go home and sort it out if it's with their partner, that this is a domestic issue. So it's, we have a long way to come, and it's got to be more than a call to action. It has to be in the actual implementation, the access to services, the access to justice for those who are survivors of gender-based violence.
Clearly, our leadership, at least in the police, at least here in Gauteng, needs to be a little workshopped, I suppose, for some of the utterances that were made. I'm sure you were hearing, you know, the conversations that followed the Lieutenant General's utterances. Some people said, but you guys are making a mountain out of a molehill. You know what he meant. You know what he meant. He wasn't trying to be vicious or in any way undermining the work of the campaign against brutalization of women and children. What do you make of that argument, Christian?
Well, I'd absolutely like to believe that he didn't mean, if those words are taken literally, he didn't mean it in that way, absolutely. But we have to come down to the fact that words matter, how we say things matters. And unfortunately, gender-based violence is the root cause of this comes down to an unequal power imbalance between men and women. Society places a greater level of value on men than women. Society tells us every day that we are worth less than men. We have less access. We have less ability to make choices. We deserve less. And when that is what you hear on a daily basis all around you in many different ways, I mean, we tell our children that all the time. Girls can't do that. Girls shouldn't play with that. Yeah. You know, that's what you're confronted with. Words matter. So we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard, all of us.
Yeah.
And whether we're a teacher, whether we're a police officer, whether we're on the radio,
yeah,
we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard and say, how do we talk about this? How do we correctly call this what it is? Start having these hard conversations that really get at the root of gender inequality and start to combat that in society, because only then can we truly dismantle the root cause of gender-based violence.
I have these conversations quite regularly, and I've come to understand that it really touches a raw nerve on men, mm-hmm, specifically whenever we raise these issues, because there is a feeling out there, particularly by men, that there is a focus on wanting to demonize men, that there is a focus on wanting to make men seem as though they are pathologically violent against women and children. And that is not so, say those that are against this conversation and the tone of it. How do we have a conversation that is going to be very, very clear about what the parameters of this conversation are and what the ills of this social reality are without alienating men?
Yeah, it's a good question. And bottom line, men are part of the solution. We cannot end gender-based violence without men. And so they absolutely have to be part of the discussion. But in the same breath, whenever we are confronting historic, perpetual, embedded injustice of any type, you have to be able to dig deep and look at your own vulnerabilities and your own sensitivities and question your own stereotypes. Everyone has gender-based stereotypes. We all buy into damaging gender norms in one way or another, and it's not until we're able to introspect and recognize our own, recognize if we've ever told our son, don't cry, don't be a girl, don't be a sissy.
Yeah.
Have we ever said that?
Yeah.
Right? And if we have, okay, we've got, that's a gender norm. We've got to challenge that. And so I think, you know, for a lot of men listening, you know, being able to, by recognizing the prevailing patriarchy, the masculine, the dominated place that men have played, it doesn't automatically make a man an abuser or part of the problem. it recognizes the truth of what is, and it makes a man a part of the solution if he can recognize that is what has existed. And once we have, if we start from that point of truth, then can we have honest conversations to say, how do I not be a woman that perpetuates that? How do I not be a man that perpetuates that?
Yeah.
And how do we need to treat each other and talk to each other differently? And it comes out, it's not until we dialogue that we realize these things. I mean, I've trained men who say to me, but I've given a woman a compliment, you know, based on how she looks. And like I say, well, to say you look nice today, that could be seen as a compliment. But to say your butt looks good in those jeans in a workplace environment can be harassment. You know, and some men will say, but no, I don't. And it's not until you break it down and ask, well, then have you made that same compliment to your male colleagues? No. Well, then why? Why is it okay to compliment or to engage in a professional way different with your female colleagues than your male colleagues? And so it's those kinds of things of just starting to break that down and understanding, empathizing, putting men to put themselves in women's shoes and understand.
Would it have made it okay if he said, yes, I have? I have made a similar compliment in inverted commas to a man. Would that have made it okay?
Well, and arguably not in a professional environment, understanding what is and isn't. But it's not until we have those conversations that we understand how that can be perceived. So absolutely. I mean, you bring up a very good point. No. In a professional environment, and bottom line, if it made someone uncomfortable, we have to take a moment to recognize that and have an honest conversation. Well, I meant no harm, but if I caused harm, if I made someone uncomfortable, then I need to recognize that. And you're right, it can play out with the same gender as well as across genders. And so it's important, though, that, like I say, we have to have those honest conversations and not immediately jump to the point of defense to say, you know, oh, you're blowing this out of proportion, or that's not what I meant, or, oh, women can't take a joke, or, you know, things of that nature. We have to stop for a moment and say, this obviously I did create offense. Or even of friends, you know, how many times have we all been out with friends and somebody makes a joke that makes you uncomfortable? And we don't say anything.
Well, one of the ways by which I have learned to self-regulate, as it were, to self-curate, self-watch is the parallels that I see in the gender justice conversation and the racial justice conversation, because they're very similar in the arguments that you see emerge whenever people are defensive, whenever people are predatory in the various conversations that we have about that. The race conversation is not doing very well, by the way, Christian. It's debilitating in its inability to move forward in what I believe is its purpose. And that purpose is to make us recognize our shared humanity. Could it be that perhaps part of the problem is how we have the conversation? In that the conversation sometimes becomes not about what we would like to see, but about what we are seeing. In other words, the gaze, the focus of society is on the now and the pain, but we don't seem to have a goal to which we are trying to go to. And I say this because it's the same question I've asked of the race injustice conversation, that we seem not to have a destination that we are going towards, except, you know, some have argued that just you give platitudes like, oh, we want to reach humanity, shared humanity. What is that? Could that be the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an element of it. And I think that it's also questioning basically our frame of reference, how we know and understand the world when it comes to gender. we learn damaging gender norms from the time we're born.
Yeah.
And so you grow up with this. This is passed down to you by respected elders, your family, your friends, and you see it play out all around you. And so when it's very easy that when this discussion comes out to feel attacked and to feel that, you know, your frame of reference, your understanding of the world as you know it is being questioned, it's a natural instinct to become defensive in that regard.
Mm.
However, it's not until, like I say, we have to own our own vulnerability. We have to be able to sit in our discomfort and as you say, have a shared humanity of that experience of, and how does that move us forward? If that we recognize we're uncomfortable in this space, we don't like that's what it is, how do we move out of that? And it's only through dialogue, through empathy, through understanding that we can actually move forward. And when it comes to gender-based violence, I mean, you make a good point in that the world has never known a world without gender-based violence.
Yeah.
As long as there has been human civilization, we have had gender-based violence. So we don't actually know what that even looks like. And I've been confronted by many people in my work that say, you know, how can we really end it? It's just so big now. What can possibly be done? And first of all, every individual who stands up, every survivor who chooses to come forward, that is a difference made. So it's important to always, you know, keep that in mind. But also, I fundamentally believe that every conversation moves the needle. And the more conversations we have, the more times we stand up, the more we take action, the more we create a society in which gender-based violence doesn't have a place.
Are the perceived failures in conversations about injustice, whether it's race, gender, whatever the case may be, perhaps part of the journey that we need to go through to bring us to one day knowing what it is that we ultimately want to achieve?
I think, yes, hard, uncomfortable conversations like this, you know, yes, they are part of the journey. And I think that if we have an understanding of what, you know, ending gender-based violence actually means, and it doesn't mean gender, people often, when it comes to gender equality or gender equity, people get confused and say, you know, is it really possible? I mean, men and women are different. So therefore, you can't possibly have gender equality. That's one of the arguments sometimes you'll hear. And it's important to understand that gender equality is simply everyone, an individual is entitled to his or her potential and choice and freedom within that. And then we have policies, structures in society that allow gender equity, meaning everybody has an equal opportunity to be able to achieve what he or she wants to achieve. And so we don't have to, I know that many men that I chat with will sometimes say, but don't men then have to give something up if we're going to achieve a gender equal society? Does that mean we have to give something up? Well, it depends on everyone's frame of reference. And I would argue men give up a lot as it is if we have the female population over 50% of the globe never having realized their full potential, never having the full economic, brain, emotional leadership potential of women across the globe. We've never had that. So I would argue that male or female, we are all giving up because of this. So to me, from my frame of reference, if we are able to truly have a gender equal society, we will all benefit to a greater extent. There is no reason that men have to give anything up. And if you're a parent, I'll say to men, but do you have a daughter? Yeah, well, do you want your daughter to have safety, security, opportunity in her lifetime?
Yeah,
do you want her to be what she wants to be?
Christiane Wendler, let me thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate this time. I wish we had a lot more time to talk about this, but thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Aubrey. We so much appreciate the partnership to be able to use these kinds of dialogues, move things forward. Thank you so much.
Christiane Wendler, Behavioral and Gender-Based Violence Manager at Shout It Now.